Well, a little vinyl on turntable number one. As we kick off Green Zine on this beautiful early summer morning. I've been hearing the frogs. I heard the peepers. And there's still some peepers out there, but heard some regular bullfrogs down in the pond. So we're going to this LP from a group called Ancient Future, pulled from our vinyl library, and this is the Frogorian Trance. Henry will be joining me in just a little bit. We're going to be talking to local author and naturalist Ted Levin. Very soon, actually, he's going to be joining us in the first half hour of the show. Green Zine is brought to you today by Solarfleck. Yeah, they're the tracking solar company based in Norwich, building a local economy. At their website, you can find out how you can go to No King's Day. There are a lot of locations, including one in White River Junction. This Saturday, we'll be talking more about that. Find out more about Bale at balevt.org and tell Elena that Free Vermont Radio said hello. Daniel Leibowitz, longtime supporter and original treasurer of this radio station, the Upper Pass Beer Company, the First Branch Coffee Company, Solarfest, and we're going to give you a little more information about them in the second half of the show. Wit and Grit, a breakfast and lunch establishment in Randolph, Vermont, and the Yes We Can Collective. We'll let this go just a bit longer, and then we'll bring Henry up in the mix. So Henry, I know you're not stressed, but is this helping calm any nerves that you may have? Henry, are you there? No, I think Henry's reaching our guest right now. Once again, some music from Ancient Future. And that was the Frogorian Trance. Yeah, it felt like pretty trance-like. And we might have the Frogorian Dance at the close of the show. You're listening to Green Zine here at WFVR-LP in South Royalton, Vermont. I believe we're still connected with Henry, but he might be still trying to get a hold of our guest. Are you there, Henry?
I am.
All right.
And I have Ted Levin on the phone with me. Are we ready to jump into visiting with Ted?
I think since Ted has a tight schedule this morning, we should go directly to Ted Levin. We've all been reading various things from him over the years, and it's glad to have you on with us, Ted, here on Green Zine.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome.
Yeah. Ted, let me, I know a little bit about your background, but obviously I'm not nearly as much as you do. you have been a naturalist, and you have served many, many roles, including, I guess, playing a role in the world-famous Bronx Zoo, and on into Vermont with doing reports in the past for what was Vermont Public Radio, now Vermont Public, which always throws me. I can't get used to that. And you've written multiple books, and so tell us just a very quick sketch of how those books played in and how you came to write this newest book that you've just completed.
Okay, well, I guess I could start it off by saying that I've been a naturalist my entire life. I'm the example of a little boy who never quite grew up. And I'm essentially doing the same things I did as a kid. It's a little bit more sophisticated now, but so I love to write. And I was stuck at home during COVID. I had just come back from leading a tour to Costa Rica, which I do yearly. And it was March, I believe, 14th of 2020. And my boys had grown up and dispersed. My wife had passed away a number of years before then. So I had a big house, 4,000 square feet and 100 acres of land, a beautiful view, no one to share it with. And stuck at home for 18 months. So rather than go to the liquor cabinet to pass the 18 months, I decided I'd go for a walk every morning, which I did with my dogs, and punch notes into my cell phone, come home and reconstruct them for a couple of birding listservs, Upper Valley birding listserv and Vermont birding listserv. Then a friend of mine who does an online newspaper called Daybreak wanted to run some of that writing. And I was taught kicking and screaming how to post it on Substack, an online newsletter. And that, you know, that became a daily routine. 526 days, some vast numbers of minutes and hours. And about 6 months into it, a friend of mine who had been following it said, you know, you have a book here. And I have about 900 people that follow it regularly across the country and overseas. And I had been getting through that year and a half feedback from them, suggestions, corrections, you name it. And eventually I realized, you know, maybe I do have a book here. So it was really, it was an unattended book. It was initially started so I could maintain my sanity.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about almost like an unintentional crowdsourcing, that feedback that you were getting from your regular readers. And we're very aware of Rob Gerwitt down at Daybreak. We've had him on the air on a different show that we do. So that sort of got you geared up, and then you put the book together. I noticed that it was down on the front shelf of the Norwich bookstore. And I imagine you've gone out and given some talks about your book. So tell us more about what folks can find in that book. That sort of covers those, what did you say, 526 straight days of going out in the morning? Yeah, that's amazing.
So the book is put together with a prologue and a brief history of place and an epilogue and acknowledgments at the end. And then the interior of the book, the obvious bulk of the book, is the day-by-day accounts. Now, I don't do all 526 days. I jettison some days. I combine some days. I added more information to some days. And I opened myself up emotionally and wrote about, you know, my life for 24 years in Coyote Hollow on some days, not all days. But enough so people can get a flavor of where I lived, who I was, and how I passed my time. But for me, the most interesting, if not mystical, part of this whole process was every day was different. I mean, completely different. Mm. You know, the sun came up a few seconds earlier or later, depending on the season. But the birds that were there, the mammals I saw, no 2 days were alike at all, to say nothing of the sky.
So I see the title of the book is The Promise of Sunrise, Finding Solace in a Broken World. How did you give us a sense of how that title maybe arose, and I guess you have a little bit about how it arose. You're keeping your sanity during COVID, but obviously it's taken a lot of work afterwards. And what do you see this, see nature and the change in your life because of actually being spending more quiet time with nature than maybe you normally would have previously?
Oh, clearly, I spent more quiet time at home. I've done a book on the Florida Everglades, a book on timber rattlesnakes, a book on the desert Southwest. So I spend a lot of time outside. But oddly enough, for a person who's a lifelong naturalist, I knew more about timber rattlesnakes than I did about the scarlet tanagers in my dooryard. And I knew more about the Florida Everglades than I did about the 65-acre marsh below my lower pasture. That all changed over the course of a year and a half. But that's how that's how I approached it. I was a self-assignment to learn about where I lived and to see how the seasons played out and the different rhythms. I happened to coincide during that 18 months with a major incursion of crossbills. They may happen every 20 years. It happened the October of 2020, and it lasted until April of 2021. And that was just great. And, the rest of my life, they may not see that again. I also had an incursion the summer of 2021 of yellow-billed cuckoos. I hadn't even heard or seen a yellow-billed cuckoo on my property in 23 years until that happened.
Wow.
Wow. So tell us about the two birds. Those are not ones that I've ever sighted.
Well, crossbills, the name implies, their bill tips are twisted. And they're twisted so they can insert them into the cones of evergreens and pull out seeds. Sometimes they have no sense of philopatry. So if there was a bumper crop of, let's say, white fir or white pine cones and seeds here, and there was a crash in the food source in the northwest or due north of us, crossbills will stay here and breed. And they can breed any month of the year, depending if there's food available. And young crossbills don't return to where they were born, they go to where food is, unlike so many other birds. It's kind of a unique adaptation for a transitional food source.
How would they know? I mean, obviously, they'll know that if their food supply where they're located originally is going down. How do they know where to go for the backup food supply?
Well, they fly until they find one.
Until they find one. Huh. Wow.
And they'll feed along the way, and then if they find a big supply, they stay.
That's a marvelous example of the niche nature of nature, where bugs and all sorts of things develop specialities, and some of them make them so they're the only pollinator for a particular plant. And some of them, like these crossbills, have a special adaptation for being able to get food out of a cone, and so they are on the move doing that and fitting into nature wherever that food is. That's quite a reversal of what you think of as things returning to the same place.
Things that depend on a fluctuating food source, snowy owls, short-eared owls, they could nest hundreds, if not 1,000 miles apart in succeeding years, depending on where the mice are up north.
Wow.
But what's really interesting, Todd and Henry, is that I haven't even gotten into the fact that red crossbills, we have two species, white-winged and red. Red crossbills are divided into 12 different song types. And it's very confusing. You have to really be a linguist to recognize them. But these different, the birds with the different song types have different thicknesses and length of bills, which are precisely adapted for different species of evergreens.
Mm. Wow. So like the Beach of the Purple Finch, which that book I read a number of years ago, where when the food supply changed and they were stuck on an island, they changed their genetics very quickly in order to adapt to be able to survive in their changing food supply. You suppose crossbills do that as well?
Yeah, well, they're literally, this is probably taken millions of years, but there's 12 different song types of red crossbills, and each have different bill types. And each one, some of them are generalists, and they're not the best at getting out, let's say, a white pine seed or a hemlock seed, but they can get out fairly well three or four different species of evergreen seeds. Some are so restricted to what they feed on that they never leave a mountain range that they're in, one call type in southern Utah. It's pretty amazing. It's so remarkable what we know, and one can only guess what we really don't know about what goes on around us, and we think we know it all.
Yeah,
which is really sad.
And with your career and your background, you've traveled to a lot of different places here in the United States, and you mentioned going to Costa Rica. Can you just kind of review the changes of these environmental areas over, let's say, the years that you've been studying and traveling there? We talk quite a bit here about climate change and how it affects both the plant, animal, and human world. What are you noticing, and maybe a little bit more focus on the place that you go every day there, your own property, things that have changed in the last couple decades?
I could tell you, I moved up to northern New England in the fall of 1975 to go to graduate school, and I never went back to Long Island except to visit.
Mm-hmm.
And in that 50 years that I've lived up here, I'll rattle off a list of birds that did not nest here when I came and are now fairly common. Turkey vultures, red-bellied woodpeckers, tufted titmice, northern mockingbirds, gnatcatchers, blue-winged gnatcatchers. So those are things I see with some, or hear with some regularity. Cardinals. So they indicate change pretty quickly because they have wings. You know, they can change their range and expand much quicker than a painted turtle or a timber rattlesnake just because of mobility issues. So those are the things I see. Whether that has to do with climate change, bird feeding stations, I couldn't tell you that.
Right.
That's debatable. I'm sure it's all things affect them. Turkey vultures are obviously not feeding stations. But, you know, turkey vultures may have come up this way because of building of interstates, because they can catch thermals off a ribbon of macadam that extends, you know, from northern Florida to Maine.
Wow, yeah.
So there's many reasons why things come and go, climate change being one of them. Climate change is really, it's a sad and rapidly evolving story. But the one thing I take comfort in is that this world has undergone things like climate change numerous times. And things get left behind, things expand, things radiate out into numerous different species. So it's sad for me to imagine that I'm going to lose species that I love, which is quite possible. But, you know, if you came back in a time machine a million years from now, you might see a whole nother suite of organisms that evolved out of something as simple and common as a chickadee. You just have no idea.
I put in the show notes a a book that is, let's see if I can pull it up here. Tim Weed's book, which is a sci-fi kind of book, it's called The Afterlife Project, and he's talking about climate change happening so fast and how the Earth will survive, but the question is whether the human species will survive, and because we're so we're really good at mining the environment and causing troubles, but in that book he sends someone forward into the future to see whether we've survived, and he finds a beautiful landscape and nobody in it.
There's a book that came out about 25 years ago called The World Without Us. And that is a great read. I don't know Tim's book, but that's an incredible read. Somebody reimagines the decomposition of cities like New York and the perpetuation of animals without us.
Yeah.
Just like Chernobyl. Everybody vacated that village, and now there's wolves and lynx and moose back there. And
it's just phenomenal. I've seen the pictures from their movies and stuff. And it's amazing how fast nature moves in and tears apart what seems like very permanent infrastructure.
Yeah.
Cement and buildings and so forth. It just...
if our planet can survive the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs 66 million years ago, it's going to survive us and climate change. We may not be here. I have no assumptions that the Earth isn't going to make it.
Yeah,
it's a question about us. But
well, I'm impressed by your optimism. We usually cover a subject or two each week that we call kind of the gloom and doom, where the CO2 emissions continue to rise at a record pace. We have an administration that just says drill, baby, drill, and we see a lot of impacts on various parts of the environment, on jobs and everything. But that more sort of view of over the eons with nature being very resilient and adaptable, whether humans can prove to be that way or not, I don't know. I'm looking at part of an article where you were interviewed in a great magazine that we subscribe to called Northern Woodlands. And one of the questions that you were asked was about who inspires you. And I see one name. Well, I see a couple names that I'm very familiar with. But let me ask you, what about the great Aldo Leopold is inspiring to you? I think he wrote Sand County Almanac. Is that something that you read in your earlier days, or how you...
That's the only book I've read more than three times.
Oh, really? Wow.
I was given, when I was an undergraduate going to college in Indiana, it was one semester I had no biology classes, and I was really bored. And my former comparative anatomy professor gave me this book. He said, why don't you just read this? You'll enjoy it. And it just blew me away.
Yeah. Pretty amazing, again, getting into nature and how powerful nature can be when you unleash it and encourage it to fix your problems.
Yeah, it's, in the history of life on Earth, it's been about five, I think maybe six times where there's been a downward dip in the rising number of species. We're living in one of those dips right now that's, commonly called the sixth extinction. And it's, and everybody says how fast it's going. Well, it is kind of going fast, but it's nothing compared to what happened when that asteroid hit at the end of the Cretaceous. That was overnight. We're talking minutes on that one. And we came back from that.
Yeah. Big shift in what was living on Earth afterwards.
Well, yeah. Mammals. We wouldn't be here if that asteroid didn't hit.
Hey, can I ask you?
And,
yeah, go ahead.
And I believe that there was, maybe you have information on this, but I believe that after that extinction, with a great reduction in the number of animals, that the new creations, the new living things that came onto Earth grew very, very rapidly. Am I right about that?
Yes. Yeah, mammals really, really radiated. And some things remarkably survived, like turtles, snakes, lizards, obviously fish. The big reptiles didn't, but that made way for mammals to radiate, become big. I mean, primates were itsy-bitsy little things. It's a miracle we survived. Primates, it is.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sickened by what's going on in Washington. Don't get me wrong. But I just think human history repeats itself, and it won't last forever, and the Earth will recover.
Yeah, that type of resilience is very encouraging. I know you've got something else coming up in just a couple minutes. I had a chance to...
I do, but I can talk for a little while longer because I'm in the middle of writing, and I decided to cancel my volunteer afternoon. So.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
We're very lucky. So, once again, I'm looking at this Northern Woodlands article, and I'm thinking also of your time spent in Costa Rica. Is that something that you continue to do, take folks down to the rainforest or wherever?
I do that every year.
Yeah.
Except during COVID.
So I'm looking at a comment that you made here where you were asked about what is the most fascinating species in the northern forest. Can I ask you about, in Costa Rica, I had a chance to go there once and it was great. And there's, I'm sure, all kinds of wildlife and trees and plants and bugs. And we're going to be talking a little bit about an article that Bill McKibben wrote recently where he delves into the insect world. Can you give us an update on how insects are doing down there in Costa Rica?
Not great.
Not great.
I just read an article in the American version of The Guardian just a couple days ago. There's a biologist named Daniel Jansen who has been doing research in a national park in northwestern Costa Rica, in the Guanacaste section of Costa Rica, which is pretty dry. I don't think we'd even call it a rainforest. And if you went there, you would feel more like you were in Arizona than were in Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously got more trees because it does have more moisture, but it's pretty dry, and birds are similar to what you'd find in Arizona. Well, he was studying insects, and the article had a a big white sheet that he hung up with lights behind it, and he was in a national park, and we're talking about an area unaffected by development or farming or spraying or, anything else that would grossly or alter the habitat. And from like 1956 or 57, he had a picture of the sheet with the light behind it, and it looked like a tapestry of moths. You couldn't even see the sheet. It was like moth overlapping moth from every corner and angle of the sheet.
Mm.
Then there was another picture from maybe 30 years ago, and you could see a little couple, some white. You knew it wasn't quite as crowded as it was in the 60s. Then he did it from a year or so ago, and you saw more white sheet exposed than moths.
Yeah.
And so he was talking about the fact that he was in he's doing this in a national park that's remote from human negative activity other than climate change. He thinks the effect of climate change on some of these insects is catastrophic because they breathe through little openings in their abdomen called spicules. And there's really no way to modify water going out. They can't control that. You know, they don't have a hard exoskeleton like a turtle might. So he thinks that climate change is causing a lot of these insects to dry out because summers are prolonged, dry season is prolonged, droughts are prolonged, and high-impact droughts are far more common than they ever were. So I personally have not noticed that because I haven't been going to Costa Rica since the 60s or performing any sort of experiments like that.
Mm-hmm.
I frequently relate to Green Zine listeners because it's such an impressive thing to me. When I was a kid, I'm 85, and so when I was a kid, right around World War II, we would drive from New York City out into northern New Jersey to a family camp, and we would have to stop and scrape the bugs off the windshield. And I hardly ever see a bug on my windshield now. And yeah. Part of it is that the cars are more aerodynamic and the bugs get scooped up and over it. But a lot of it is that there's just a heck of a lot less insects than there were back in those days.
Yeah, I remember driving across the country with my parents in the summer of 1957, and it was the same thing. My father had to stop at gas stations and scrape and wash and. And I remember crossing the Mississippi River in Arkansas. And this is when I was in graduate school in Texas. And this is only, 50 years ago, so a lot sooner than 57. I remember seeing mayflies 6 inches deep along the windowsills of the gas station.
Wow. Amazing. And so... So that then, it isn't just the disappearance of the insects, but those insects are the food source for lots of birds. I mean, they all fit into the ecosystem. Can you comment on that and how the interrelationship between species are?
That article I told you about in The Guardian talked about the worldwide decrease in lizard abundance, snake abundance, songbird abundance, and amphibian abundance. And it ties it back to a decrease in insect abundance.
Mm. Yeah. I'm always blown away by just how powerfully nature works when it's diverse, when it has all of its components, isn't missing pieces that are critical for closing loops.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, just look around here at what the damaged deer are doing.
Yeah.
And the rising incidence of Lyme disease. We have no deer predators. Occasional coyote gets one. Occasional bobcat might get one. But, without something like a catamount that would eat a deer every 4 or 5 days, or more frequently if they had cubs, kittens. It's no wonder, there's more deer in Vermont today than there ever was historically or prehistorically.
Yeah.
And pretty amazing that the introduction of top predators then heals the ecosystem, which has been now demonstrated in Grand Canyon area with bringing things that would take down deer there where the deer were populations were expanding and then crashing and expanding and crashing.
Yeah, we brought wolves to Yellowstone, and you hear about all the problems on the border of the park, people wanting to hunt them. But there's been studies in the park about how the wolves don't control the number of elk, but what they do is they keep the elk moving. There's a new science now called the ecology of fear. And, freaked out elk don't stay in the same place. They keep moving and grazing, probably like they did, the whole species' existence. And because of that, plants are coming back. Wood ducks have returned because willow and cottonwood trees are getting big enough that there can be cavities in them big enough to support families. Beaver have come back. This is a whole suite of things that have come back just because wolves keep moving the elk and they don't stay in the same place until there's no food left.
Yeah, it's that supposedly the buffalo and the predators driving them into tight groups is what built all the topsoil in the Great Plains.
Yeah, it's all pretty interesting.
Yeah, and just to go back to the deer population and the tick population, I've had conversations, and I think all of us personally who get out in the woods and the fields are over the last few years finding a lot more ticks. There's a recent story about some effort, and I guess through maybe some modern biological science, to maybe try to reintroduce a new version of the catamount into Vermont. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. We know that deer hunting, is the number of people that deer hunt, at least in Vermont, has gone down. So
yes.
I'm not sure how that control of deer is really going to happen. I know that my partner and I are very much in favor of not having just open shooting of coyotes. We know that coyotes occasionally do take down a deer, and they're really not very destructive to other species. So I don't know how that's all going to sort itself out in the coming years. Do you see many deer down on your property? I guess you do.
Yep, I do. And, you know, I have a German Shepherd who's kind of old. He doesn't get around very much, but he barks. And when he's outside, he constantly is barking, and that's because he hears deer.
Yeah.
Huh. I have a daughter in Stowe with a dog, and that dog goes out and barks, but it's barking at bear.
Yeah,
I
do the same thing. He's beyond treeing bears at this stage of his life.
So, any positive? I mean, you've laid out some positive thoughts that if we, even going through an extinction, we will have new diversity filling those gaps, and world will carry on. Any other either positive or thoughts about how to smarten up and make Homo sapien a little less extractive?
Huh. Well, I would sweep out this administration and start over again.
Yeah, maybe a new birth of new species to take over for the current administration.
That is it is. It seems as though the least qualified people were selected for the most important jobs in this country. If somebody wrote this in a story and I read it as a novel, I wouldn't believe it.
No, yeah, one or two unqualified people, you'd say, well, that they slipped through the net, the people that should have been interviewing them, looking at resumes. But this is clear that, I forget the guy's name, Lee Zeldin, maybe the head of the EPA now, and people that come from the oil and gas industry. Yeah, it's pretty deliberate. I guess we'll have to wait it out, although Henry and I will be talking shortly about No King's Day, which is coming up here in just a couple days, away for the people to try to speak truth to power, because we're not getting a whole lot of truth. But tough times. But if we focus like you do with your morning walks and observing nature and really communing with nature in a non-invasive way, that really I think gives all of us and our listeners some hope during some darker times for the environment and nature.
You know, I was watching indigo bunting singing today at the top of a spruce tree.
Mm.
Yeah. Like, you're standing there looking at the sunlight off that ultramarine feathering.
Yeah. It's an incredible color. Yeah.
It was great.
Well, Ted, I want to thank you so much for spending a good half hour with us, a little longer than was originally scheduled. And it's a real pleasure to hear your insights, and look forward to reading some more of your material and maybe getting a copy of your new book.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to be on here and talk to you guys. Keep up the
Yeah, so just once again, The Promise of Sunrise is the name of the book. And Ted Levin, thank you for joining us on Green Team.
Sure. Thank you for inviting me. Bye, guys.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, Henry. Good talking with Ted there. So we've got about 19 minutes left in the show. We have many different directions we could go in from here. What is your preference?
Should we jump into Bird Notes and listen to that?
I do have a window open. Let me take it over there. And then why don't we play Bird Note, and then you can let folks know why you chose this particular topic. Just to remind folks, if you're just tuning in, you missed our interview with Ted Levin, but the show is up for replay starting tomorrow morning. I think it might replay on the air on Mondays pretty early, like 6 or 7 a.m. if you're an early bird, but it will be up to stream whenever you want for the next week starting tomorrow morning. So we're going to go to Bird Note now. This is the real story, and we'll be right back with you here at Royalton Community Radio.
This is Bird Note. Human events are sometimes chaotic, violent, and appalling, often unpredictable. Particularly when gripped by certainty that they possess absolute truth, humans are capable of great destruction. But human events are only part of the story. They are the surface waves and storms beneath and beyond which the enduring cycles of nature go on and will go on. The waxing and waning of the sun's light will orchestrate miraculous transformations in the natural world. Bees will go about their orderly work, reading the world in ways invisible to us. Birds will make their courageous journeys across the continents, navigating by ancient codes and intelligences. The equinoxes will proceed to find their balance of day and night. As Rachel Carson wrote, those who contemplate the beauty of the earth find reserves of strength that will endure as long as life lasts. There is symbolic as well as actual beauty in the migration of the birds. There is something infinitely healing in the repeated refrains of nature.
That almost sounds like an introduction to a documentary about nature, Henry. I like that.
Yes, I thought it was that dates back all the way to 2013. That Bird Note was published. But I thought it was apropos to follow up on our visit with naturalist Ted Levin.
No, and you chose that ahead of time. You clearly were given some good thought to that, because once again, those cycles of nature, they may adjust a little bit, but there is sort of an immortality to a lot of the sun. You know, obviously the sun coming up and the sun going down, and the solstice and the equinox. And actually, I just want to remind folks, the solstice isn't too far away. As early summer, it will be coming up on Friday, June 20th in the evening at 10:41. So if you're planning a solstice party, Henry, you're going to have to stay up a little later for that.
Aha. Well, yes, I it's always amazing how long the days get here. And my daughter living in Port Townsend, Washington, where the separation between Canada and the United States swings north about, she gets an extra half hour of daylight over what we get here in Vermont. It's pretty amazing that as you go north, those long days get really long. I was in, when I was a teenager, I went to England and I camped out in a white tent just outside of London in Henley. and on the longest day of the year. And there were only about 2.5 hours of real darkness. It was amazingly short night. Could read a newspaper at midnight.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So we've got, let me see. I got something I'm going to hold on to because it might be a future guest. But one of the lead articles in the current Green Energy Times, which just became available in the last couple of weeks, and you can find it in a lot of places in this area. I know there are copies at the Tunbridge General Store, at the local hardware store, at the co-op here in town. If you happen to be going to the local bank in South Royalton, there's a stack of them there. And it's a lot of interesting reading on various subjects, whether it's the environmental views of the new Pope, surveys of what citizens in this country and other countries of the world feel about climate change and their fellow citizens. In fact, I'm going to stick with that. And also a lot of information in this current issue. It comes out every couple of months about EVs and how things are going with charging and also with the used EV market. But in this front page article, it apparently, I don't know if you feel this, Henry. I'll just ask you flat out. Do you get a sense of just sort of people that you might bump into on the street if you were asked, well, what do you think the average citizen in Burlington feels about climate change? Is it really an important factor to them, or is it kind of low down on the totem pole, et cetera? Do you have a sense of that? Because this survey is saying that a lot of sort of, you know, real pro-environment people, like folks that might be listening to this show, have a sense that their fellow citizens, yeah, they really don't care about the environment that much. And yet this survey says, no, a lot of people do care more about the environment than you would suspect. What's your sense of that?
Well, I know during the last presidential campaign that the polls almost didn't list climate change as something to be concerned about. And that spooked me because I think of people as having at least on their radar, and certainly even the red states where so much large-scale agriculture is happening, a lot of those people are being driven off their land because of climate change. They literally can't survive farming anymore because of the prolonged droughts and the extreme floods. And sometimes within the same year on the same farm. So I think I have a biased perspective, but I think that that people in the Burlington area would be on top of climate change and be pretty interested in it. Certainly the neighbors on my street that I live on up here on Nash Place, every single one of them I've talked to is aware of and concerned about climate change. And since buying a used EV vehicle, I've been paying more attention than I have been about EVs. And I had learned to spot every single Tesla that went by, but there are so many EVs up here that have absolutely no marking on them that indicates they're EVs. And I've started to recognize those cars as well. I think that Burlington has a particularly heavy electrified car fleet or presence here. But so I don't know the answer for sure, but it seems to me that it's, I mean, I think, you know, Al Gore had traction. I mean, he came within a hair's breadth of becoming the president. And he was all about climate change when he was running.
Yeah, and that is the, I'm remembering that election. That is the easiest election to run by the numbers. The final vote in that presidential election was 5-4. for those historians of presidential elections. Henry, just to stick on the EV front, so I've turned to page 5 now in Green Energy Times. So as far as running some numbers on EVs, and I would agree with you, other than maybe getting a license plate, which may end up being a future thing, and we know that in the state of Vermont, and I'm not complaining, that one of the ways that the Department of Transportation has been trying to capture some funding from EV drivers who are not paying a gas tax is to have a higher registration fee. So there is now in place, and some people might be scared by that. In fact, I heard someone interviewing the other day, and they're saying, hey, I used to pay, $65 each year to register my car, and now it's more like $140. Well, that's sort of capturing the money that's needed to keep the roads up that all of our vehicles, whether they're electrified or not, are using. But from this article, actually published by Efficiency Vermont, which you can find in Green Energy Times, says here that nearly 18,000 EVs are now registered in the state of Vermont, with 50 dealerships using Efficiency Vermont's dealer incentives to service and sell EVs. And that is a 41% increase on the road of EVs since last year. Now, I don't know about that. That seems like a bigger jump than I'm seeing out there. But you're noticing it. I know here that the chargers over the years, and it's a good way to monitor locally, although not all of them are working yet, and I'm talking about chargers on the campus of the Vermont Law and Graduate School. But I have information from an inside source that they will most likely have all of them up and running pretty soon. They are level 2, and they are free. And the plan from the college, from the law school, is to continue making those free. So interesting that the adoption rate, the goal in New England, and I think Maine, New Hampshire, New York, and Vermont were part of an effort that started back in 2014 to get to a certain sort of penetration level of EVs. And as of late, actually last summer, slightly ahead of schedule, regionally, that goal was met. But we know with some decisions obviously being made, as we discussed earlier, down by the current administration, but also a decision made by Governor Scott here in Vermont recently, that is some bigger headwinds towards getting more of our transportation electrified.
It's interesting that the electric grid has not grown because of EVs, which use about the same amount of energy as our heating and cooling of our homes. Mm. So it should, as the EVs come up, we're only at, I think, 12-13% of the Vermont cars are EVs. And I think that's new car sales. I don't think that's cars on the road, but I'm not sure. Maybe you have that information in your head. But and we've moved to heat pumps and as well, which use electricity. But what's driving, because we're getting so much more efficient, we're not seeing an increase in demand for overall electricity. And what's driving that demand is data centers and artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really happening in spades, and it's a wake-up call to the grid operators that they have to be able to figure out how to move a lot faster than they've ever had to move before. And is the problem. My sense is, I think we've talked about it on the air once a long time ago, there was an addition of volts, which in urban areas was talking about in Europe, where people will put in the equivalent of a parking meter outside their house, make a slot through the cement sidewalk, and let people charge off of their home electric service and get some money for having done that. Maybe help pay part of their electric bill for their home use by renting out charger space. And I think that that's certainly a limitation in the urban areas here, is that a lot of people, renters especially, cannot do home charging. And that home charging just makes so much sense. My electricity from Burlington Electric, if I charge just overnight when they have low rates, I'm well under a dollar a gallon for my gasoline, equivalent.
They are giving you a break there. That's good.
Yeah, 7 cents a kilowatt.
Yeah, yeah.
And my car is reasonably efficient, so I get I get 4.3 miles per kilowatt.
That's good, boy. Anything, I think the standard, well, I've seen some big rigs that are like 2.9 and then maybe 3.4, but if you're above 4, Henry, you get an A in the EV report card. You're being very efficient.
It does tend to go away if I drive 70 instead of driving 63 on the interstate.
You gotta dial it back and try to preserve that battery. Yeah.
Speed in gasoline cars and in electric cars soaks up the energy, gives you a place to waste energy.
Yeah. Hey, Henry, I'm going to point out something else. Do you have the current edition? I'm sure you can get the Green Energy Times in Burlington.
Yes.
So check that out. But here's something that you don't have, and I will send it along to you. There's someone who wrote to the Herald this week and is talking on a big, big scale basis of carbon capture. I'll get his name in a moment, but financial boons for climate cleanup. The World Bank, local banks, institutional investors, and investment firms should design and offer a loan package to investor-owned utilities to profitably upgrade their power plants into negative emission power and storage stations. Instead of emitting CO2, these redesigned plants would capture, reduce, and reuse CO2 gas from point of emission to make synfuels or feedstocks like graphene or calcium carbonate. So this is the kind of, this is meant to be complimentary, wonky person that we may want to talk to, Henry. So I'm going to send you a name along because I think he lives locally and maybe we can get him for a future show here on GreenZine. But that does make me think of this article in Bill McKibben's Substack, which you sent along and I actually had a copy of. It's interesting, down in New York City, their comptroller is asking up until the end of this month, asset managers in the city have to submit their climate strategies to the city and trying to get as close to net zero as possible, and that their plans are real and actionable. If those plans are not actionable, they got to go back to the drawing board. It reminds me of the piece that we did on the woman who works in Wales, I think, who was monitoring projects like that.
The Minister of the Future.
You do remember, the Minister of the Future. We need more ministers like that around the world, for sure.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn it back to you one more time after I acknowledge our underwriters here on Green Scene, and they do include the Yes We Can Collective, just about to collect some money for the radio station by going to the Redemption Center. Also, Solar Fest. More about them next week. Anyway, if you are interested in helping out put up their solar array over the next few weeks, drop a note to sororadio@gmail.com. You want to help put up a solar array? Write to us at the radio station, sororadio@gmail.com. Also, thanks to Solaflect, Bail, Royal Trailworks, Daniel Leibowitz, First Branch Coffee Company, and the Upper Pass Beer Company. I've left you 40 seconds, Henry.
Okay, so there's two more articles, that Bill McKibben article that Todd referred to. Has a lot of other fascinating things in it. If we paved over all the cornfields, we would supply all the energy for the United States, with solar panels, that is. And a politically interesting discussion with Peter Buttigieg and Heather Cox Richards, a link to that.
Nice.
Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, more about Heather Cox Richards in the future. Thanks a lot, Henry. We'll see you next time on Green Scene, WFVR-LP.